Hello and welcome to the Humanities District, a podcast about creativity and community engagement in higher ed. I'm Jay Howard, a senior instructor at Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri. I like to talk to faculty, staff, students, alumni, and community members about their work. Our topic today: there is an ongoing plagiarism scandal that literary magazines around the country have been dealing with, and there's no one better to help break down a story like this than my guest today, Professor Mike Jesniewski. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast may recognize Mike from the episode we did back in March 2022 when we spoke about Moon City Review, which is Missouri State University's very own lit mag with Mike at the helm. And so with that, welcome back to the podcast, Mike Jesniewski.
Thanks, Jay. Glad to be back.
When I was looking at the classes that you're teaching this semester, I saw Flash Fiction, which is a 100-level class. And then we have fiction, Advanced Fiction, a 300, 500, 600. And then Small Press Production, both 500 and 600 level. And I assume that the Small Press Production, being the class that focuses on Moon City Review, is the class that you had some discussion starters furnished for you from recent real-world events.
Yeah, I definitely filled a few class periods up unexpectedly with kind of a topic thing. I remember about 5 years ago, there was a big eclipse on the first day of classes, and my neighbors were these students in an astronomy class, and they were there with their like big glasses on, like drawing like eclipse pictures in like a box thing that they made so they didn't like go blind. And I'm like, wow, that class really goes downhill after the eclipse, like the massive, like once every 300 year eclipse that just happened today. Like, this is like major, like it's kind of the same thing happened with this, where there's this major plagiarism scandal, like the first week of classes. And then it gives us this huge topic to talk about and kind of distract us from things. And then we had a lot of follow-ups. I've given kind of a daily update about this as the story's evolved. But yeah, that was I actually, because it's just about creative writing and writing and ownership and artistry, I just kind of talked about it in all my classes. But I think I said on Monday and Tuesday in classes, like, okay, this is it. We're not going to talk about this anymore, even though it's a pretty major story.
You know, I mean, in context, it seems like plagiarism and cheating is a topic that's in the news all the time in different contexts, whether we're talking about the Harvard story a while back, or pick pretty much any industry or contest, and there's been a plagiarism or cheating scandal. But let's focus in on the present one. How did it first come to your attention that there could potentially be an issue? And we'll kind of go from there.
You know, I saw the, I'm going to feel pretty comfortable right here to say the name of the alleged plagiarizer, because that's been posted everywhere. It's a writer, and I'm not 100% sure who the writer's real name is, because I think everybody in the world has said it's a pseudonym at best, and but it's somebody named John Cucera.
John Cucera.
K-U-C-E-R-A. Okay, I have actually addressed this with the alleged John Cucera at the alleged John Cucera's email address, so I feel comfortable using that name here. I think in social media, I think it was last or two Fridays ago, so during week one of classes, I saw somebody post a social media message like, John Cucera, you stole my poem. How dare you? And it kind of like, I was on my way out, or I was like walking and I just saw it like as I was flipping through like, you know, a Twitter feed or something. And I'm like, huh. I know that name, because we had just turned, the day before, we had turned our 2024 issue of Moon City Review, which, by the way, is in. I'll show it
hey, awesome.
For Jay to look at here. But we turned this, so spoiler alert, things turned out. But we had just turned it in the day before on Thursday, where we approved the proofs of it. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to get started printing on this so we can have it for you. We have a major writers conference happening in Kansas City next week.
AWP.
The AWP conference. So we're like, well, we want our new issue to be at AWP, which is kind of our deadline every year. And just coincidentally this year, because of COVID rescheduling, it was earlier. Usually it's around spring break in the middle of March, but it was supposed to be in Kansas City in 2021. They moved it to 2024, but I think they had to get an early slot. So it's the first week of February. So we're like, okay, let's get this magazine done and let's turn it in. And we were really kind of patting ourselves on the back because we had the issue done. And I was even telling my wife, who's our poetry series editor and our main copywriter, name's Karen Crago, is it a great that we're done with this already, that we're not fumbling with this or trying to beat deadlines or expediting shipping? A couple times I've paid let's pay $300 extra for overnight shipping because we want this in time.
Yeah.
We're really ahead of the game here.
I love that. So things are going great. You met an early deadline. They're ready to start printing the final proofs.
And then boom, never will I, and I told our department head this, never ever will I be early with anything again. Because I saw that one post on John Kucera and I didn't think anything of it. And I went along, I had a couple meetings that I went to, and then I was driving to pick up my kid from school around 3 o'clock. And all of a sudden there's all these messages in my inbox from people I didn't know. There's message requests and there's all saying hey, you should check this out. You should check out this John Kucera. Because earlier that day I had posted a list of all the authors who were in this issue of Moon City Review, a list of 53 authors, and you tag people and you kind of get people excited about it and they share it. So
yeah,
people were telling me, strangers that I've never talked to before, hey, you have John Kucera listed in your author list. And this has just exploded today where he's been accused of over 30 cases of plagiarism today. So I'm kind of in the car line, which is this claustrophobic place where you can't move and there's desperate parents.
Yeah.
Trying to get closer to their kids. And I'm kind of hemmed in on the side of this road and I'm looking this up and I'm oh no. Maybe he didn't plagiarize everything. But by the time my kid got into the car, I had looked up the alleged piece by John Kucera. Sure enough, as soon as I looked it up online, it was written by somebody else a couple years previously. And so we had a situation on our hands.
Oh my goodness. So yeah, car line, going about your daily business, last thing you need. So what was the first step? How did you react?
I will regret this my whole life, but I called the printer and I did not say stop the presses. But I did say, hey, are you printing the book yet? That print order from yesterday go through that we were all agreed upon? And they're like, yeah, the interior is just about done. We got about 100 copies left to print.
Yikes.
And I explained to them what happened. And I was just panicking because I thought, well, this happened. And, they were really sympathetic. They're a really good crew here. It's the campus printing services here. And they really understood what was going on. So I'm kind of like, okay, well, I have other calls to make. I'm just letting you know. And they asked, should we stop printing them? And I thought about it. Yeah, I guess so. So they stopped the presses, literally.
Okay.
So then I called other people. I got a hold of the original author of the work. I found her email through her website, and I emailed her, please call me now. We want to talk about this. You could look this up, that this is happening.
So this is the author of the work that John Kucera stole.
Yeah, it's a writer named Darcy, Darcy Dodd, I believe her name is.
Okay.
And she basically said, okay, so then I got a hold of the head of English, Dr. Linda Moser, who's the kind of the chief person at the press, and she just I kind of got in to talk to both of them at the same time, and this is all happening at 4 o'clock on Friday, the first week of classes, so everybody's kind of winding down, the printers are ready to go away for the weekend. And so I basically just I got in to talk to Dr. Moser, and she was as supportive as could be. She says, let's do whatever we can to get rid of this. And she even said, we'll even back you if you want to start over. And it's double the cost of printing, which is a big deal because we're not flush with, tons and tons of cash. And printing is our main expenditure every year. So to double that that's a big commitment for her. But I believe that she really wanted this to be okay and was going to do whatever. So that was good. And then I talked to the original author, and she was also understanding. She was very glad, and I made her one promise that we will take care of this somehow, that this person will not steal your work. You know, and then I basically started like, well, what can we do to fix this, and what are our options? Okay, right. So that's – and the printers were going home for the weekend, so they're like, well, what are our options here? Because if it was completely done, we would have probably put in like some kind of card inside the issue, kind of like, hey, this happened. Please ignore this.
Yeah.
Sorry that this happened. But since they were mid-production, we asked them for some options and how much it would cost us. And that's where we were basically on Friday.
Okay. And so after you got those options, did you end up opting for the reprint with and did you replace the author that was taken out?
Yeah. The good news was I kind of set this all off on Friday evening. Like, I put together like a list of things that we could do and talked to the printer and what they suggested. And what I just kind of waited. We had a couple days to wait. And then Monday was the ice day, was like the bad cancellation ice day. And I'm like, well, we're losing another day here. But the printers, again, I can't talk kindly enough about them, that they had actually worked on this from home and they ran up some estimates. And really,
wow.
The luckiest part about this was the back cover, the cover of our magazine wasn't printed yet. And that would have been like the real expensive thing, like the full color card stock like that went through that. So that wasn't. So we were able to do that. So we had an idea. So for something very affordable, for them to reprint those pages. And then what the people in the printing services had to do is to go through every copy and pull pages out. Like, they're printed on these big flat 8 pages per sheet, and they're all stuck together. So what they did is, like, for every stack, they went through and pulled this page. They had to pull pages out and then resubmit new pages in. And they were willing to do that.
Wow.
Very labor-intensive thing, and for not that much money. But then we had to find something to replace. So this was a 2-page flash fiction story that was plagiarized. So we had to find something that was 2 pages long to keep the table of contents and like the order of the pages in. So there wasn't like, hey, what happened here? There's numbers missing in the middle. Which was another option. Is like, well, what you could do is just pull the pages and have a gap there. And I'm like, well, that's not ideal either. So we had to do that to the 2 pages. We had to do that to the table of contents. And then we do contributors notes for our authors at the end. And so we had to do that. So it was 4 total pages, which meant 3 different places the printing people were going to have to go through and pull pages out and replace. And they were willing to do that for something that was very reasonable. So we went, and I went searching for a 2-page short story in our submissions. And that wasn't actually that hard to find. We get a lot of submissions. I contacted that author, the same thing, like, this is weird, but call me right now. I like your work. And that's really weird for 2-page short story writers to be like, it's Monday.
Sort of a dream.
The world is frozen. Call me immediately. Don't talk to anybody. No. So he's like, hey, what's up? And so I explained it to him. And he was like, oh, okay. And I'm like, we would have liked this piece anyway, but it would have been next year. So he was all on board. We had him sign a contract. I checked to see that he wasn't plagiarizing anything. Just for the heck of it. And then I got the pages to the printer, and they kind of fixed it. So with kind of a lot of worry and a lot of effort on the printer's part, we were able to fix this pretty minimally, and now it's completely eradicated from our issue. There's no sign of this happening.
Like it never happened.
Yeah, within our issue.
Do you get the sense that fixing the physical copies was like done by hand, like taking out the pages?
Yeah. There was people that, you know, we had a 600 print run to start, and they had all about 100 printed. So they had to go through 500 stacks of these big sheets of paper.
Oh, wow.
And they had to pull out these pages one by one.
I mean, yeah.
This, and they had to do it 3 times per stack, because again, in the front, in the middle, and in the back of the book, they had to do it. So there's like 1500 things they had to pull out and replace with new pages. I mean, it just sounds like the most tedious thing.
Well, I want to put this in the context of like the other cases that other journals have caught the same author, but just based on what you've said so far, my take on this is that you know, this is, it's basically, what's it called? Like a stress test. You know, if something goes wrong, and is, how will it be handled? A, by the community of literary publications. It sounds like they came through sharing news about it on social media. How will it be handled by the editors, by the printers? And it sounds like everyone responded in like the best possible way.
Yeah, we were really lucky that this happened when it happened. I mean, the timing in some way is terrible that it was in 24 hours after we turned in our files and they started printing. But it could have been worse, because like 3 days later, the book would have all been printed and bound, and we would have had to put like a retraction card in at best.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, let's go through now and let's print something that talks about what happened, give the original author's name and their information so you could look that up and give them credit. And it would have been an artifact of this process. Like, we would have had this, because a lot of the victims of this, a lot of the journals that did this weren't print journals. They were online journals. So those people, they just went in and shut it down. They just like took it off their website within like a couple clicks and it was over. So
could have been even worse. And it sounds like this may have happened in some cases where the, you know, the edition was already printed and like in people's hands and people didn't realize it until way afterwards with some of these earlier cases. And because I've saw that people have changed, rather than removing his name from the list of contributors, they just changed the blurb about him to be like serial plagiarizer.
Yeah. I mean, different people reacted in different ways, to it. You know, I talked about this, like we started here, I talked about this with my classes a lot. And what everybody wanted to know was, what retribution could we bring to this guy? You know, there's the questions like, oh, well, did anybody call the police? And then I had to sit back and think, like, is this an arrestable offense? Like, is this something like, you know, this guy plagiarized poems. Like, here's his address. Go get him. Get the paddy wagon and go go get the SWAT team and, like, bust through the windows and the skylight. Like, he's just plagiarizing at his computer. And like, no, what's happening? Like, that wasn't going to happen. Like, I think that's, like, more of a lawsuit, like, breach of copyright law. And, you know, and I really can't say that I know 100%. Like, I don't think you can, like, on spot just, like, arrest somebody for that. Like, that's not... Like,
no, I don't suppose so.
You're not going to find a patrolman, like, Patrolman O'Malley is walking by, and it's like, get him! Like, so it's there was that. And people are like, well, can you get lawyers involved and sue him? And that was a big question. And, you know, we're a university body and entity, and we have lawyers at the university that I've talked to, because they help us with our contracts and they're very nice. And I think, yeah, we could have called them, but I think the answer would have been like, well, what are the damages here and how worth it is it, like, to get, you know, the university lawyers are doing all kinds of things constantly.
Yeah.
You know, to get this plagiarism thing that's been fixed at a minimal cost, what are they going to do about it? And somebody brought up, small claims court, but this is something we could take, because the money that we spent to fix it is really what we're talking here, you know, plus some time and effort. How much are we really talking, and is it worth it?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the plagiarism is an ethical violation, but money has also changed hands, not just the money spent to fix the problem, but also the money that he, I'm assuming it's a he, you know, whoever this is.
Yeah, we don't really know. I think it probably is. I think because there is a name that people have thrown out for who it is, and it's just another name, and I'm not 100% sure.
But some journals, I don't know if Moon City does or not, but, you know, they pay authors for the pieces. And so he's through fraud, stolen a bunch of money.
Yeah, that's where it comes down to fraud, where you really start getting into it. I've heard online on social media that one, he won a contest with a plagiarized piece and won $50. One thing that was never going to happen with this was he was never going to get any money from MSU. Mm. Because what had happened with his contract is that we accepted this plagiarized piece at our last meeting, our last kind of like class session to get pieces for the issue in early December. And I filled out the contract and I mailed it to him right before break. So I did that with about five or six other people. We come back from break where mail is shut down and the offices are closed, like January 2nd, January 3rd, the mail's there. All these other contracts from these other authors are back, so we can proceed. His contract comes back, address unknown. So I go look it up in the system, and I'm like, oh, do I have the right address? And I noticed that, like, he lived on South something street, and instead of a South, I wrote S, and I'm like, I know what it is. My terrible handwriting. They thought that was a 5. His address is right here. This is crazy, because there's no red flags in my head yet. I just have bad handwriting. So I redo a contract, and I very legibly write South instead of S, and I send it back, but I dropped him an email and said, sorry about the contract. I sent a new one, so look for that this week. And all he wrote back was said, is there payment? And so that didn't seem that weird. I mean, you know, writers like money as much as anybody who does anything. And that was his, but now that's a red flag, because when I originally sent him the acceptance, which lays out the terms and asked them to accept terms, it says, you know, is this your property? Do you own it and have the right to publish it and sign contracts for it? He wrote back and said, I agree. That was an email. I'm like, okay, well, let's go forward with a official paper contract. But I went and proceeded anyway because he had agreed through email, which is pretty legally binding that he agreed to these terms. But all he said when I sent out the terms was, I agree, is there payment? So then all these red flags then are like, okay, now he's just in this for the payment. But what the million-dollar question that everybody has is on social media and my classes – in my general just life is, if this is a scam to get money, why pose? Like, aren't there a million other scams in the world that are so much less convoluted and complicated than submitting to literary journals? And, you know, literary journals, the average response time is 6 months to get, and so far he's gotten $50. So if you're scamming the literary world to the degree, like a few dozen cases at least so far, and your motivation is money, like, Aren't there a lot of other ways? Can you not pose as a Nigerian prince who wants to share his fortune with you? Like, aren't there a million other ways than, like, you know what, I'm going to take poems or short stories that are a page long, and that's the way, you know, that I will pave my driveway with gold.
Well, it is hard to put oneself in the headspace. And I believe you had mentioned in a social media post when you reached out to the individual on the topic of plagiarism, they responded back with the phrase, that looks good, or something like that.
Yeah, I guess I forgot that whole thing is after I contacted our press head and the printers and the original author of the piece, you know, this is already broken by so many, like 30 other people had reported this. I'm like, okay, well, this person deserves their due process and consideration and the benefit of the doubt. So I wrote him that immediately. I'm just like, hey, John, you are probably aware of this, but you have been called out for a lot of allegations of plagiarism across by a lot of different magazines. I looked up the piece that we accepted and found that it was published by a different author a couple years before you submitted it to us. I want to give you the chance to explain yourself. What's going on here? I look forward to hearing from you. And about 15 minutes later, I get the answer that just says, that looks good, with no punctuation. And so then I gave him, and my response to that was, well, that doesn't answer my question. Can you answer my question about the legitimacy of your work? And I haven't heard from him since. So on Sunday night, a couple days later, I wrote back and said, well, I haven't heard from you. I've given you the chance to defend yourself. I am officially canceling this publication and this agreement, and I am going to report this in any avenue I can on social media.
Yeah.
And that's all I did. I didn't even say, and I actually waited, like, should I say good luck, or should I say stop it, or I hope that you don't do this anymore. I just stopped it at that. You're canceled. I'm reporting this. End of email.
And yeah.
That's where that stood.
Do you mind if I ask, so what does, in terms of the contract, what does Moon City Review pay authors for a piece like that?
Oh, we don't. We pay in copyright.
Oh, and copyright.
We're trying to pay people. Literary magazines are iffy because we are not that old in the world of literary magazines. We've only been a national literary magazine for 11, 12 years now, where we're taking outside submissions.
Still, he may have made more than $50 when you think about all of the other publications that were accepted and all the other places. It's possible some of them may have paid.
I have not seen that reported. I think it is possible.
Okay.
Venues do pay, but some venues pay $25.
Yeah.
You know, me as a short story writer, the most I've ever gotten, I think, for a short story personally is $500.
Wow.
you know, and sometimes, and usually when you get it, you don't even realize it because it's so infrequent. Like a check just shows up in your mail for like $50 and you're like, what is this for? And then you kind of like start doing some math and investigation. You're like, oh, I published that story. So yeah, again, I can't imagine there's a more complex way to try to make money than to steal poems and wait this out. Like it really isn't like that efficient of a scam.
Has anyone floated the idea that, I'm interested in whether technology is involved here and whether this guy is just a chatbot? And the reason I'm thinking about that is because it seems like all of his emails have been three words, you know, like maybe just auto-generated replies based on flowcharts, you know, and because it does. It seems like it's his full-time job trying to plagiarize all this stuff. But if somehow he has some sort of like computer program to pull stories and submit them elsewhere in an automated way, maybe it becomes viable.
You know, I spent my class periods for like a whole week then kind of, and one of the big questions I asked everybody is like, why? What's going on here? Let's try to explain this craziness. And somebody in one of my classes said like the exact same thing. Like it's the three word responses without punctuation. This sounds like an auto response thing. So I think that's viable. I mean, it seems somewhat directed because the only other time I contacted him is I sent his galley. He's like, hey, please look these over. Let us know if you have any changes. And I got a response back from that just said, looks good. So that was at least applicable.
Yeah.
Like when he was responding, it wasn't like, I love those two, you know, or some weird thing that didn't apply. So I think that's a possibility. Sure.
Okay.
I don't know how those work that well or how that would help you, but I, you know, if that's what he's doing and this is, he's found a way into the submittable system. Submittable is the program/website used for literary magazines. I know it's used for a lot of other things like job interviews and resumes now, but like it started for Lit Mags as a way to submit to journals and for them to process your work and then get responses to you. If he found a backdoor into that, that's like, hey, if I do this automatically, I program this. Sure. I mean, if somebody can make submittable, I'm sure a computer programmer could make something that hacks it and auto submits things to it. Sure. Why not?
I'm familiar with submittable from my ongoing quest to earn 100 rejections over the course of my life. It sounds like as awful as the situation is, you know, everybody was doing their job. No one was asleep at the switch. But I have seen, as I was reading about this, some of the, especially from the publications that, you know, they didn't catch it in time. They're issuing apologies and we should have caught this and all kinds of these other statements. But as I reflect on it, I'm wondering, like, how is it even theoretically possible to catch stuff like this? Because a lot of the, I mean, the whole point is a blind review. For a lot of these, so we don't, sometimes people are submitting anonymously and it's not like there's any mega database that will catch plagiarism. So what is your, what's your opinion on that topic? To what responsibility does the journal itself bear?
Well, part of this is on me. This is our process. What you could do is, and it's anybody who's graded essays from a student or anything like that, what we could do is type random passages from the work into Google, put quotes around it so it'll come through exactly, and see if it comes up. Okay.
Okay.
So that's how I found out in the car line. Going back to that part of the story is I found the piece, and I only had my phone because I was in my car. So I'm like looking through my phone for this. I had a PDF because I'd sent him the galley via PDF. I went and copied the first sentence of the story from the PDF, and I put it in Google in quotes. Boom, it came up right away, the original piece. Okay, so why didn't we do that? Okay, and that harkens back to this was early. Our deadline is usually in the middle of March. Oh. This was in early February. The class that you spoke of, Small Press Publication, English 540, 640.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things they do, or they have the last 5 years since the class is run, is like, I will bring in all the accepted work and say, hey, here's a step that we need to take in this process. And I divvy it up among the 22 people in the class. Everybody take three pieces from the journal and do that. Like, just type in a couple random phrases. Type the first sentence, type something from the middle, use quotation marks, see if it comes up. The previous 5 years, because we've had time to do this, my students have come up with zero instances of plagiarism. Okay, because there's just a lot of good faith going on.
Yeah.
And plus, we have these email agreements. Like, this is yours. You own this. You have the right. So because we had to be early this year, and because everything, and this is so rare, we didn't do that because we didn't have class. Like, the book was done before the class started. Now, could I have done that all myself? I could have. And I should have. This is showing me I should have done that, and I didn't. Because if any one of my students in that class would have had that piece, and they would have typed that first sentence into Google, they would have had it come up right away, and it would have been really obvious. So
I see what you're saying.
You can't catch people. Now, could he change a word in every sentence and make it go through? Probably. It's like, you know, trying to catch that, you know, English composition plagiarizer. There's so many different ways to do it, and you can't prevent it 100%. But there are basic things that you can do, and that's what I think journals can do. And I think that's the message for all of us in the literary magazine community going forward is, okay, we've been working on good faith for so long and assuming that people aren't doing this, but now here's this person that's spitting in our faces. I think we all have to do our due diligence a lot more effectively moving forward.
With the rise of chatbots, I've heard some journals have like circled the wagons entirely and aren't even accepting, will only accept submissions from people they already know. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, because if you, like, you know, you teach at Missouri State University, that was the talk of our orientation week and all our back to school meetings and stuff, you know, from the provost, the president, all our department heads was, how are we going to officially deal with AI?
Right.
Because I found out about AI and ChatGPT last January, and I didn't know. And so I didn't really have a policy in my syllabus because my students already had my syllabus. So we talked about it. But we talked about it this past August a lot. And I talked about it this January, just a few days before all this happened, you know, where the first day of classes. And hey, you know, this is part of our world now. And I just want to hope that none of you are majoring in creative writing or minoring in creative writing and taking these advanced classes. And this is how you want to get your degree. Like, why would you major in creative writing? Like, why would you spend all this money so you could turn in plagiarized or automatically, you know,
generated work,
produced work? Like, I would have to imagine that you're not in it just to get the assignment done and to get points for it.
Right.
So we kind of have that message going. Yeah, I have heard that. I have heard journal colleagues of mine that have said, I'm only taking work by writers I know already. And I know a million writers. I could make literary magazines now until I die with only work by good writers that I already know. But that's not really part of our mission, is to just,
well, exactly,
keep static. Like, oh, well, nobody else can get on the ship. Everybody else is going to be like, that's not why we're in this.
You have to have at least a mirage of hope for new authors.
All right, new authors, you are officially no longer needed.
Well,
check again when everybody else is dead.
You mentioned also in a post, let's contact Submittable, get his account deleted. You may have mentioned that, but I saw in, I saw in one of the articles, maybe it was the Plagiarism Today, which if anyone wants to, you know, read about this online, you won't have any trouble at all finding all kinds of news outlets and other newsletters reporting on this. Moon City Review, as well as the other journals, have all been collated together, everyone who's hit. But I think I saw that Submittable did shut down like three different accounts associated with this serial plagiarizer.
I think that's good. But I mean, of course, what he could do is just make up a new name and start again under a new name.
Yeah.
But it's good that they're at least like compliant and trying to help. I don't have anything, you know, the Submittable people have been, you know, really great about everything since they've been around for about 15 years or maybe a little longer than that even. And you know, they're part of this world as part of as much as anybody. And it's good to see that they stood up and said, yeah, we're going to do this. Not like maybe certain social media platforms when somebody does something horrible. It's like, well, let's see. You know, you don't know.
Yeah.
We're just going to keep them around because who's to judge? Like, Submittable acted pretty quickly when they were called out. So good for them.
One other, you know, question I have is kind of on this, just on this topic of people acting in good faith. I mean, we've sort of seen this to some extent in politics, where if someone decides to take advantage of the system that expects good faith, then there's like not any safeguards in place to prevent it. And in part, that's by design, because we want an open society. We don't want everything to be locked down and everything. And so we sort of rely on the good faith, and that creates a free rider problem. But there are a variety of other conventions in the literary magazine world that I wonder to what extent they are checked and to what extent they are just presumption of goodwill. And the specific example I'm thinking of is the policy on simultaneous submissions. Is that something that people have any way of checking?
No. You know, for 25 years, I've been in on that conversation. I think it's died down a lot. You know, I think the quote unquote old guard of literary magazine editors, simultaneous submissions, just for the audience, are like when you say you have a short story out there and you're submitting it for publication. Simultaneous submissions mean you send it out to multiple magazines at one time. And then the unwritten rule that's really kind of written is whoever says yes first, you take that submission, you take that publication, and then you immediately withdraw it from the other journals, so they're not spending any more time on it. A lot of the old, especially esteemed magazines, said no simultaneous submissions, and they would go so far, if you withdrew something from them and said somebody else took it, they would cite their no simultaneous submission policy and blacklist you from their journal and be like, well, that's not very good. I think we've evolved away from that policy, and 95% of the journals out there publishing don't have that policy anymore.
So if we had someone who is shameless and they did simultaneous submission, maybe they notify that it is a simultaneous submission, maybe they don't, and then it's submitted somewhere, or it's accepted somewhere, and then they don't withdraw it from elsewhere, and someone else accepts it too. And so both publications publish it thinking that they are publishing it exclusively. That may or may not be caught as well, it seems like.
Yeah, that happens quite a bit. That's happened to me at journals a few times where we caught somebody. And then what we do with literary journals, the print journals, is we exchange. Like, we have a list of 75 journals in the United States that we send copies of Moon City Review to, and they send us our copies. So we have a big library of journals on the third floor of Sisliff Hall where we just exchange. It's like, hey, look at our journal. Get your students to look at our journal, and we'll get our students to look at your journals. And it's been a nice system that's been in place since before I was in this. So we get these journals in the mail. I got one in just the other day, and I always look through the back cover, and I'm like, oh, I know this author. And, you know, I look up pieces, and then a few times in my career, cool, we just published something by this guy too. And then I look it up, and it's like, we just published this exact piece in our journal too. So those people get caught, and they're kind of shamed and blacklisted in another way, because it's kind of more of an auto-plagiarism thing.
Uh-huh.
The rights that we ask as literary magazine editors, and I believe every single literary magazine on earth works like this, except for Zoetrope All Story, which is owned by Francis Ford Coppola, who takes all rights for your stories because I think there's some notion that he's going to turn them into movies someday. Not that he's made a movie in 15 years, but like, but every other journal in the world takes what's called First North American Serial Rights, which we say that we want the rights to this. And as soon as we publish it, the rights automatically revert back to the author. And that is standard for magazine periodical work, is that we only want to print it once and then you can have it back. So like, you want to put that poem in a poetry collection in a year or two or down the line, those are your rights again. So
yeah,
so you can't sign over First North American Serial Rights more than one time.
Well,
okay.
Yeah.
Go to Australia, go to Antarctica or Asia or Africa or any of those other continents, but North America, that's us.
any of those other continents. Man, I would just be so embarrassed if that happened to me, if I tried it and got caught. So that
is, you know, it happens. And basically one guy was just like, well, why not? It's mine. It's like, well, you signed a contract that said this. That's why.
Yeah.
If you hadn't signed a contract. And, you know, what's fun is that the editors of the other journals that it happens to, you get together and, you know, it's like, hey, we all did this. Why are you doing this to us? And, you know, you can't say it like, you know, you can't play mom against dad if mom and dad are both standing there. So I know how we put that
Absolutely.
Together. It's pretty easy to do.
And the reason for that in the first place is just because every journals don't want to be publishing what other journals are publishing. They want something unique for their own pages.
Right. And, you know, that's the way that we keep things going. And like we said, keep those new authors going. Because somebody who is really talented, like you could be O. Henry and you could publish The Gift of the Magi 150 times, you know, oh no, the watch chain and the combs. Oh no, what irony is happening here? And if O. Henry publishes that story 100 different times, that's taking away 99 slots from other writers.
Yeah.
And then no new writers ever get a chance to do that. So we kind of one-time publishing and then go put it in a collection later and we'll celebrate it there again. But you get one shot at a journal.
Well, so if we look into the future, you know, I noticed people are reporting John Cusera doesn't appear to have been stopped because there's not really any way to stop someone who is anonymous and shameless and pseudonymous and stuff. Do you think that this will die down, or has he like made his point and will maybe move on to something else? What do you predict?
Well, I reported this on social media because we had a reading on campus, a live Zoom simulcast reading with one of our authors, a writer named Leanne Warpaw, who is the editor of South Dakota Review. And we were kind of in this pre-Zoom chat, and we just started talking about this. And she had received a submission from him 2 days prior to that, which was about 4 days after this whole thing broke.
Mm-hmm.
So he had been made aware that people knew and that they were posting on social media, and he was continuing to submit to other journals. So I think now that submittables canceled him out of their system, probably we won't see that again until he finds another name. I don't know, because I don't know what the motivation was. And that was, again, the main question I put to my class is, like, why do you do this? Like, is it, you know, if it's money, that's ridiculous. Okay.
Right.
Somebody and people in each one of my classes suggested maybe it's like a study. It's like a sociologist, okay, who's like, well, I'm going to try to do this experiment to see how people react to this. I don't know what you're proving with this, you know, other than, like, well, good work is good work. And, you know, if it's published once and it's published again, that just proves that work is good. So I don't know what the study would be and what your thesis and your conclusion would be in that study. Or who in the world would be interested?
Who would care? Yeah, it's not like there's no valid point being made. There are other examples of I don't know, journal fraud and stuff, but they're sort of unrelated to the point we're talking about now. I remember learning someone wrote like a bogus cultural criticism article, something about the social construction of like quantum mechanics. Or something I'm just making that up, but it's not a real thing. And wrote it just to see if they could get it published, if they used enough big jargon buzzwords of the moment. And then it did get published, and then they revealed, oh, this is all just a bunch of cotton candy. They'll publish anything. But that was more poking fun at social sciences and cultural criticism. So it's not really a related example.
Yeah. You know, there's examples like, I mean, we talked about Stephen Glass. You know, the whole shattered glass story about the guy that was making up his stories for, I think, was The New Republic, you know, which is a really good film, by the way.
Okay.
It was 15 years old. You know, there's the J.D. Vance Hillbilly Elegy story where we found out that a lot of those details about his so-called, you know, hillbilly life were not real, and he made them up. You know, you talk about that study. There was a poet, I'd say 20, 30 years ago, and I can't think of his name off the top of my head, who he was a kind of a white American guy from the Midwest. And he wrote a book of poems about Hiroshima that were supposedly from a Hiroshima survivor. It's like 80-year-old woman that had been through it. And everybody loved this book, and it got on a big press. And, you know, it was lauded as this just beautiful, heart-wrenching like thing about the survival tale. And then he wrote an essay and published it and said, hey, that's me. Discuss. You know, it talks about authorship and kind of this new school criticism idea of the author being dead. Like, these are the same words on the page. Why did you like him when you thought it was this, like, real person versus me? And it's like, oops, I don't think that worked out for that person.
Well, there's often an obvious difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Right. I mean, but his, you know, I guess he was trying to prove it. And he's the one that called himself out on it. So at least that happened. So it didn't take somebody else to call him. That's still fraud because he still signed a contract.
Yeah.
Under somebody's name and stuff and got money. I mean, it's fraud, like you said before.
Did you say the Hillbilly Elegy was fabricated?
I believe that is, yeah, that was an Oprah book, and it wasn't completely fabricated, but he took a lot of license with what are these things that happened to him.
Okay.
And that the Oprah apologized, I remember, for that. And then that became a film shortly thereafter, and that film just absolutely bombed. That was a big Oscar bait film from 2020. And,
yeah.
You know, big stars, big director. I believe it's a Ron Howard movie. And I don't know if people were sitting there like on their way to the theater, you know, like, well, what are we going to see? Well, not that, because that was like auto-plagiarized. Like, we're not giving our money to that kind of garbage. Like, but it just didn't do well. And so he had to deal with that.
The author that I was referring to earlier, his name was Alan Skoal, S-O-K-A-L. He wrote a 1994 sham article, submitted it to a journal called Social Text. And he was a mathematical physicist. And it was basically a satire just to see what he could sneak into a humanities journal disguised as postmodern pseudo-intellectualism. I can't find the name of the piece, but Stanley Fish was, I think, on the editorial board and
I actually know who that is.
Wrote about it.
Like, yeah. Is there a text in this class guy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find really quick here. Now that you looked up yours, I want to look up mine, the Hiroshima.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I found it. It's a writer named Kent Johnson. Okay. And I believe Kent Johnson passed away a couple of years ago. And the name of the person that they made up was Araki Yasusada.
All right.
And that was published by Wesleyan University Press, which is a pretty major poetry press that got fooled by this. So, yikes. Okay, but then again, this is somebody like, I mean, I think it's a slightly different case when somebody's auto-plagiarizing or double-publishing something or making things up and they're fooling people that way.
Sure.
Because the victim list is a lot smaller, but like this person, this John Cusero, who is stealing work from other writers, you know, I think that magnifies the crime quite a bit, because then there's other writers who work really hard, you know, to have their own creativity. And we, as we discussed, there's not a lot of money involved in this.
Right, right.
So like what you get out of it is like, hey, I did that. I get the accolades and the affirmation that something I produced was liked by other people, and someone has stolen that from you. So like when you don't have a lot and someone steals that little bit from you, I think it's a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is horrible. Awful thing to do. Thank you for breaking this all down with me. This episode should go to press. I don't know if that's the right term since it's a podcast. Either right before the AWP or the week after the AWP, because I know that's all right upon us.
Yeah, that's like 5 days away. I'll be there in 5 days. That's crazy.
I couldn't resist going myself, even though I'm not in an English department. I'm in the communication department. English and communication, though, are together in one school now. And since it's so close to Springfield, I just had to go. I want to go check it out and see what it's like. And there are a number of sessions at the conference I saw that are on the topic of academic podcasting. So I will be attending those and excited to learn all I can. What do you have on your docket in terms of any presentations? Or I'm sure you'll be there selling the journal as well.
Right. We tried to go all out as like we are able to go all out at something like this.
Yeah, because of how close it is.
Of how close it is, and this is kind of our backyard. Plus, we're kind of using it as a recruiting tool and also as an alumni get-together event. So we have at the book fair, which is this massive event at AWP where it's like an airport hangar filled with, like, I believe it is close to 1,000, if not over 1,000 different book and press vendors are there set up selling their wares and publicizing their works. And there's author signings, places hand out information about their programs. So it's this big event that goes on the whole conference, and we have a double booth this year. Usually we get a booth. Ooh. We have a double booth so we can put our feet up. we have that, so you could catch me at that almost anytime. I have a panel about literary magazines in Missouri with four other literary magazine editors from from Missouri. I think I call it Show Me, Show Me, Show Me Literate Magazines. I'm combining a couple things there.
Nice.
I have a couple readings off-site at night that I'm doing personally for my own work. You know, the big Missouri State event besides the book fair is on Thursday night at an establishment called the Parlor KC. We are having an alumni reading at 6 o'clock. That's for 2 hours, and we have 9 prestigious alum from Missouri State University's program reading their work. And then from 8 to 10, right after that, we have our Moon City Press authors reading. And I have 11 or 12 of my Moon City Press authors who are going to come and get together, and they're going to read from their new work and kind of hang out. And it's a relaxed atmosphere. It's at a bar with food, you know, bar food and stuff like that. So it should be fun. We do one of these every year, and it's a lot of fun. But the Alumni Association's in on it. We're really trying to put the word out, like, hey, come on out to this event and, like, meet people. I'm starting to get the idea that if we keep publicizing this, there's not going to be enough room in this room for how many people might show up. It's a 75-capacity room, and we've been publicizing it so much, and I'm kind of starting to get worried about that.
Well, good problem to have.
Yeah, that is a good problem to have.
I am. I'll plan to come. You know, it's the book fair that I really couldn't resist. Like you said, I mean, last book fair I was at was like probably Scholastic in like fifth grade or whenever they stopped doing
it. And they bring that to your school for you. They put it up in the library.
Yeah. And it's always like such a delightful time. And so it is to say that there's a book fair for grown-ups is like catnip to book people.
It, you know, it's really what I tell my students is, because I've really been trying to tell everybody in our program and all the people in my classes, like, go to this, because next year it's in LA and it's expensive to go to LA. Last year it was in Seattle. It's expensive to go to Seattle. You could drive up. So I actually have students from my classes carpooling together. Some of them are going up just for the day. You know, a lot of students have family or friends that live in Kansas City, so they're going to stay there. So kind of for a minimal cost,
yeah,
I think we're going to get a lot of people up there. And that's good. That's why they move it around every year. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, if you can't afford to fly to Seattle, maybe next year it'll be drivable for you and a lot more reasonable. I'm hoping that we have a really strong Missouri State presence, that, you know, that maroon and white, the Pantone 505 is just full force in Kansas City.
That's right. All hail maroon and white. Well, I'll see you there.
I'll see you there, unless I run into you before that, which is like